Remember when, this is going to sound facetious, but it's not facetious. When Kistler used to have, maybe they still do have those things like hide an egg or hide a diamond or something. The people who are the most fanatic, tape record every clue, analyze every clue, walk over every foot of ground, they really invest the fanatic time and effort to find those eggs and things. That's the clue to this. If you tape record everything I say, memorize everything I say, and even memorize the inflections, where I got excited, where I went real fast to it, that means I didn't care that much about it, you can't help but know exactly what's on that test. Now, you may have other things in life to do besides that, I guess, but if it was, and so you may have to temper that, but that's really the key to this thing is, I was driving over, I was trying to think of what I would explain. If I came up to me and said, hey, I blew that quiz, I don't know what's on the next test, I want to quit this class, it's too late, what do I do, help me out? I would say to me, because I've been in that spot, exactly, in college classes, and I remember what I either was told or learned the hard way after failing class or something, was, and we don't have to do that, but is that there's kind of two ways that this material is being presented and going to be tested. One is little synopsis, definitions, and descriptions of events, people, laws, and treaties, and then how that fits into a bigger context or picture. So, whenever you have those websites before, one of those websites is a lecture, just like I'm giving, and the other is almost kind of like glossary definitions of each of these things. So you could familiarize yourself with a glossary definition of person, colony, law, uprising, etc. Or you and then you can also, through the textbook, through the two lectures, mine as well as what's on the web, try to get an overview of cause and effect of what leads to what. And a lot of it is just constant exposure until you finally have it down. Another feature, and I think I may have mentioned this before, it may sound silly, but it really works, is capture a family member and teach it to them. Because as soon as you get to a point where you can't really explain what's going on, then you know that's where you're in trouble and you need to look back up a bit. So that's another technique to work on. Does that sound helpful? You know, this is again going to sound facetious, but I think history courses compared to something like calculus or physics is like if someone says, fly without mechanical help, I just can't. But if someone says, walk to Tulsa, I'd say I can't, but I could if I sweat a lot and try. So that's a history course, and that is, it's just a lot of memorization over and over and over. But if you love the material, it's not gruesome. So that exhale tells it all. So any other, as though there had been a comment there, any other things you should mention? Well, then I guess we're on to more of the revolution. So far on our new sheet, the only sheets that will be on the next test and or quizzes, the key items that I'll be testing over is starting with item 3, Pontiac's conspiracy or uprising or rebellion. You may recall that I mentioned kind of two reasons for that. And here's where I'd like to write a test question. I might write a test question that would say, the Shawnee Rebellion led by Pontiac that occurred in 1763 came about as a result of, and then I would put something like, the encroachment of American settlers in west of the Appalachians as well as, and then here's your three choices. And I try my best to come up with two or three choices that look good. I mean, like if there's something else going on in 1763 or there's another Indian happening or something. So it would actually be as dissuasive as possible. And then the real answer would be because the practice of giving aid or foreign aid that the French and English had done during their previous wars was rescinded, and no longer were these Indians able to be self-sufficient on their own, something like that. Now that's a topical answer as opposed to an item. So that's kind of the way things work. Is on the quizzes, I'm looking for a noun answer. The tests, I'm putting the nouns out there and you're giving me an explanation answer, choosing from something. So that's what I would do with Pontiac's conspiracy. Might mention Amherst and the smallpox blankets. That would probably more likely be who did it. There are a series of laws that occur in 1765, which are all sponsored by the Grenville administration. So George Grenville, first Lord of the Treasury. There is listed here in number 8, Sugar Act, Currency Act, Quartering Act, and Stamp Act. So those kind of that lends itself to two possible questions, and that is, which of the following laws was not passed during the Grenville administration in the early 1760s, and I'll pick something like a Townsend Act or Intolerable Act later. Or I might say, give a definition in which of these laws does that fit. So it's pretty much factual retention. Okay. Writs of assistance, if I wanted to be especially mean, I might somehow parallel that up to one of the Bill of Rights, and you'd have to remember which one, the fourth article it is, which is not a bad thing to know anyway in case you're getting illegally searched and seized by our authorities. But I wouldn't... Yeah, like, you know, we didn't have to worry about that as much as more recent times, so... Okay. Other features of Grenville's administration, along with number 8, are the items in number 9. That is another reshuffling of bureaucracy, the customs service reform. But a significant note here is changing it so that smugglers were no longer tried in civilian colonial courts with juries, but rather put into military navy courts where the juries were missing. Which may have, the intent of course was swifter, more severe justice in order to make sure that the smuggling stopped. But that would run against what concept? Yeah, the jury, or trial by right of jury of your peers, which goes back to both the English Bill of Rights of 1689 and all the way back to Magna Carta. In the high school class, we were talking about whether or not colonists were being profiled, like driving while black. And yes, exactly that's what's happening. That they were being profiled as colonists, being considered more guilty than other English, and having special laws that were not fairly passed being implemented over them. The Stamp Act gets more publicity than most because it opens up a constitutional question. So we're still back again repeating what we went over. But the Stamp Act's controversy is that it is a law on the surface, according to the colonists, if every English person was required to buy the, or every English business person was required to buy these stamps and place them on their products, throughout Scotland and Ireland and everywhere else, and it wouldn't have been an argument. I think it still would have been an argument. It would have been at least a complaint. But there would have been no constitutional argument. Their argument was that internal taxes, and internal tax is one that must be paid within the colonies, are only legal if passed by their own local legislature. The exception would be is if it's a tax that applies to all the empire, like a navigation law, they would accept the legality of that coming from Parliament, not their own local legislature, because by definition it wouldn't be internal, it'd be external, it'd be for everybody. So that was the great complaint against the Stamp Act, is it violates their rights to pass a tax over them that only affects them, that they had no voice over. No, pardon?
What did you say about constitutional?
That's a good question. That they, when you argue what is constitutional before there is a constitution, it kind of means we need to talk about that a little bit. The English Constitution, then and now, is, well, maybe the way to go at this is, the American Constitution is a document. Regardless of how many court cases or laws follow, ultimately a court case and a law in the United States is only going to hold if there is document basis for it in the Constitution. That's how we were raised, that's what we believe, and that's what we established after 1787. And it's a chartered system that is very dependable. The English argue that we are not flexible enough, that we are outdated, that we're stuck on a document that needs changing, that we can't muster the votes to change. Their current argument is the English Constitution is whatever Parliament says it is, and that Parliament always reflects the immediate will of the people, therefore it is a more flexible, reasonable document. Well, that's a good excuse when you don't have a Constitution. I guess you won't make that argument. In reality, the English Constitution has historically consisted of the Magna Carta. Those two things passed in 1689, which is why the Glorious Revolution was of such significance, the English Bill of Rights and the Act of Toleration. So we've got three documents so far. Magna Carta, English Bill of Rights of 1689, Act of Toleration of 1689. And then on top of those, which are kind of big landmark treasured documents, on top of those is the long-running history of parliamentary law and court cases. So the real reality is that if Parliament changes its mind about what is constitutional tomorrow, that's the English Constitution. So what the colonists were arguing is, by the traditions of Parliament, by the traditions of the English Bill of Rights, writs of assistance or taxes without, like the Stamp Act, without their approval, violated the traditions of constitutional law. Of course, by what I just explained, it is constitutional. Because if Parliament says it is, it is. So there is kind of the debate is, how over, I need a word here, how superior, I guess, how supreme is Parliament in the lawmaking body systems of the English legislatures? In the minds of the English government, it's the only legal legislature. In the minds of the colonists, there are two tiers. There are local legislatures, there is Parliament. And that becomes something that, we made it up to the Declaratory Act, right? In 1766, yeah, 1766, when the Stamp Act was repealed, not because the English accepted it as being illegal, they just repealed it because they were pressured by boycotts and losing money. When the English Parliament repealed the Stamp Act in 1766, in order to make sure that they didn't admit any loss of authority, they turned around and argued Parliament can make the laws to bind and tax the colonists in all cases whatsoever. So they're really saying, yes, Parliament is still supreme. Even though we repealed this law, Parliament's still supreme. And the other shoe not dropping is your legislatures have no authority. And I think when we got into talking about the Townsend Acts and how governor's salaries no longer were tied to the legislature, this was their recognition of the obvious, that you cannot farm out to the legislature's financial responsibility and still turn around and claim they have no authority. So that was one of those ways of trying to take away any recognized authority. And if there's going to be any legislature authority at all, it's going to be what Parliament wants, as in the closing down of the New York legislature until they pass those laws. So Stamp Act argument was the colonists made, expressed at the Stamp Act Congress in New York in 1765, as well as through the Virginia Resolve in 1765, is that if we don't have a voice in the making of such tax, and it doesn't apply to all the empire as an external tax, then it is an illegal form of taxation. And then the parliamentary response back was, you do have voice, you do have representation. Even if it is an internal tax, don't say you're not represented, you're all taken care of. Which they didn't feel they were, and they weren't. Okay, so then up to 13, last time we were here, we talked about a year after the repeal of the Stamp Act, there is a new series of taxes passed in 1767, sponsored by Chancellor of the Exchequer, Charles Townsend. They were passed because Townsend had caved into pressure by wealthy landowners to reduce land taxes, and he still got a deficit from the French and Indian War that now he has the responsibility to replenish somehow. So these new taxes on lead, tea, paper, paint, and glass were supposed to do both. Replenish the deficit and make up for the shortfall in the tax reductions. And it does seem strange, doesn't it, sometimes that tax reductions for the wealthy come at some strange times when there's already budget troubles and problems and commitments and things and potential wars that have just happened or will happen. Maybe there just isn't ever a smooth tax cut time. I mean, there probably is, but liberals like me won't let it get by without complaining. In addition to these taxes, the Townsend Acts, or the Townsend Laws, put it that way, include another reshuffled bureaucracy with the creation of the Board of the Commissioner of the Customs in 14, and with the authorized, encouraged use of the writs of assistance. Now, we recall that the writs of assistance were first authorized in 1696, but were not really pressured upon the colonists. Now they will be, and they will be with governors who will really watch to make sure this is put into effect, because now governor salaries, promotions, retention of jobs are based on how well navigation laws are enforced, not ignored. In 15, we mentioned that the New York legislature was officially closed by Parliament until their first act of business was to allocate money for billeting and for quartering of troops, which they don't do. There'll be three different quartering acts you'll need to know. First one is the 1765 one that stationed troops on the frontier after Pontiac's uprising. The second one is this demand that New York fund the troops, which it will not respond to and do. And the third and final one will come in 1774, when it'll go so far as to say that since the colonists are not appropriating money for the troops, what are we going to do with them? If they're not going to build barracks for these troops, where will troops be placed? In private homes. So it's that 1774 Quartering Act that puts troops into people's homes irregardless of people's choice. And that's why our Amendment 3 is voiced the way it is. However, let me discuss something here about Amendment 3. 1765 is the first one. 1767 here with the Townshend Acts is the second law related to quartering. And then 1774, which we'll look at in a collection of laws, will be the last one. We'll find in the Constitution. Amendment 3 says, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law. So that means, can they still put soldiers in our homes even if we don't want it? In times of war, they could. And is it possible, and I'm not trying to be facetious here, just taking advantage of the situation, to manufacture a number of opportunities to declare a war on something like drugs or terror or something? Okay. So if you got into a pattern of seeing perpetual forever war, could that mean they could put troops in your home at any time without your consent? So have we gained any real rights? Is there any difference between Amendment 3 and what was going on with the Quartering Act of 1774? Yes. Well, we gained a tradition, that's true. And it hasn't happened yet, so that's a good argument, if you want to go based on history. But there's something in the wording here I read. Let me read it again so you can find it. It says, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law.
Oh, they have to pass a law.
They have to pass a law, which the Parliament did also, right? Still, so what's there's got to be some difference there. Both the bums out. Exactly. That's the key element there, is that we could not elect people to Parliament. We were virtually represented and quartered. But in this particular law, if they make a law that we don't like, then we as voters, if we care to turn out, and we do more and more these days, could vote and either approve or disapprove such an action. So Amendment 3 has teeth as long as we have elected franchise rights. Okay. Still reviewing from last time. Samuel Adams and James Otis, two prominent, important demagogic figures, or Adams more so than Otis, who set up a communication system or network to friends and to newspapers in different colonies, trying their best to keep people alerted to whatever British abuse was taking place in the coastal cities. You could say that the revolution is kind of carried forward on three fronts. It's carried forward by wealthy, well-educated, erudite scholars like John Adams, like Jefferson, like Dickinson, we're going to talk about in 17, do essays that move large money into place. You could say it's also carried out by people like Samuel Adams, the more street thug type demagogue, which there is a place for that at times. Not always, but in this war there was. And then there are just the soldiers in the field from all walks of life. So therefore, everybody had a role in this, and Samuel Adams is very critically important. Dickinson represents that more erudite, deep-pocketed, upper-educated elite who advanced the revolution. He is a law professor. He's item 17 here. New material now, a new stuff. A law professor from Delaware, who also owned and lived and had property in Pennsylvania. In response to the Townshend taxes, he writes an essay called Letter from a Farmer, sometimes called Letter from a Pennsylvania Farmer. Let me take this opportunity to confuse you with something you're not confused with, so I shouldn't do this. You will find in your readings, possibly, another essay called Letter from an American Farmer. Letter from an American Farmer is by a French-American colonist writing about equality and opportunity and social history and race mixing and multiculturalism. Great essay. It's not this essay. So if you see it, don't memorize it for the test. Dickinson's is different. Dickinson's letter, the letter from a Pennsylvania farmer, argues that Townsend may claim, and Townsend did claim, by the way, I forgot to mention this, but Charles Townsend said, everybody in the empire will have to pay taxes on lead, tea, paper, paint, and glass. Since it's for the whole empire tax, it's not, by colonial definition, an internal tax. It's an external tax. Being an external tax, like a navigation law, don't hear any complaints out of you people over here. Shut up, pay taxes. Pretty much what the Townsend argument is. Dickinson's response to that is, although by the letter of the law, it seems as though all are expected to pay taxes on lead, tea, paper, paint, and glass, the truth is, we're the only market. We're the ones that buy it. You're not marketing, sending this anywhere else in the empire. So therefore, the spirit of the law was like the spirit of the Stamp Act, an act whose purpose is just to raise money and to milk it out of us, not everyone. Therefore, if the spirit of the law is an internal tax, our spirit is, we won't pay it, we don't think it's legal. Well, that's getting to be quite a leap there. To go beyond just saying whether or not a law is substantially constitutional, it's going so far as to say, we don't like the spirit of this law, so therefore it's substantially unconstitutional. And that's where Dickinson's taking this argument. Of course, the merchants and the anti-tax people love this argument. And so it doesn't take much for the boycotts to resume. And from 1768 through 1770, again, there is a standoff between American merchants and British merchants to see who will cave first on a boycott, whether the Parliament will cave first. The freedom-fighting Sons of Liberty also come back and resume their threatening of customs agents. And the threat is so great that numbers of troops from the frontier are moved into interior cities in order to protect customs agents so that these taxes can be collected. You may recall in the Stamp Act that there was so much intimidation that they never even collected the Stamp Act and it was repealed. Now they're going to try to hold firm, collect the taxes, protect the tax collectors with these troops, which means there's now going to be the presence of British troops in American cities, especially Boston and New York. And what's the purpose of the troops going to be? Enforcement of laws that aren't fair laws. So the original purpose of the troops was to protect against Indians, actually to protect Indians against colonists moving west. And now they're in the cities there as fascists, literally, to enforce what's considered unjust laws. Which is exactly what Samuel Adams and James Otis thrive on. Now they have ill will and anger to continue to spread their propaganda over. And an event on March 5th, 1770 furthers their cause. It's a cold March day, and a crowd of would-be Sons of Libertyists and other angry people have started to swell out of a tavern, and a bit over-inspired by spirits, as they gain a courage they probably wouldn't have had otherwise, and begin to yell epitaphs and curses and criticisms against these soldiers, who feel overwhelmed and call for help. And there's multiple stories that go with this. When I visited Boston on the tour with my wife, one of the ones I heard that I later heard on the History Channel, so it seems to confirm, was that at this, that's two sources, right? Tour guide and History Channel has got to be true. Plus, tour guide heard it from the History Channel, but anyway. The story they tell was that Boston had a volunteer fire service in which certain people, with store owners on certain corners, were to yell fire to the next block if they needed help. And apparently there was a fire at that exact time. And so as the store owners were yelling fire across block to try to get the volunteer fire people out into their business, this was confused by the troops of thinking they heard an order to fire into the crowd. Did so, resulting in the killing of five people, the first one being an African-American sailor named Crispus Attucks. who was like pretty absent from history until the 1960s. I mean, that's when he first started being celebrated. Five people, I mean, it's any loss of life is a tragedy. So I don't mean to make light of this, but does five fall into the category of massacre? I would think not. I mean, 950 people were crowded off a bridge in Baghdad last weekend. I mean, I didn't hear the word massacre used, but here the word massacre was used. Because Samuel Adams used it. That's why. He's the one that gives it this title, the Boston Massacre. And Paul Revere makes the famous engraving you may have seen. He didn't see the incident, but he drew it up from Adams' account, who also didn't see it. And that was spread about and spread to all the colonies. So now they have something. British bring the troops into the cities and start firing upon innocent civilians to intimidate people. So the Boston Massacre unites, generates, causes more and more anger across the colonies. And in that same year, England responds in Item 20. But before I move to 20, let's go back here and mention this. While Samuel Adams is spreading the propaganda that worsened the reality of what happened, his own cousin, future president John Adams, saw the incident and realized that the troops, in the climate of what was going on, the troops would not get a fair trial. And so he offered his services as lawyer to defend these troops and got them acquitted. That didn't make him a very popular person in the early years of the Revolution, but he felt that was an ethics issue that had to be stood for. Anyway, same year. Item 20, 1770, a new prime minister takes power in England and will be the prime minister from 1770 until 1782 throughout all the pre-war and main war years. Frederick North is his name. And North feels that all the ill will caused by the massacre, and really caused by the Townsend laws, is doing no good for Britain. That it would be, if the boycotts cause business to break down, the ill will is bad, there needs to be something done to cool off this fervor. And so he urges Parliament to repeal the Townsend taxes. Not all the Townsend laws, but the taxes. Which they do, all except for that on tea. Not so much because tea was a great profit trade item, just he chose tea as being the way to suggest that we still have the authority to make this tax, and in the spirit of the Declaratory Act, we're going to keep the tax on tea. So that's what happens as of 1770. And as an effort to try to diffuse anger, it really does work. Because there's just not that much resentment against one small tax on one item. And even though Samuel Adams and Otis and others who would like to see things get worse are wringing their hands, for most colonists, problems are over. And a lot of historians have argued that if there had been no more laws of Parliament, if they just left it at that, the likelihood is we would have stayed a good loyal colony, maybe received Dominion status like Canada did around the 1850s, and finally renounced the Queen around the 1980s. That's what Canada did. But things didn't stay that way. New laws would be passed down in 24, but we're not to 24 yet. Talk about items 22 and 23. From 1770 to 1773, for that, we're on item 21, then we'll jump to 22. Does it help to have these sheets? Some people say they get all confused by them. Okay. You can always just hide them. Their only reason they're here is because I don't want to write on the chalkboard. So. But I hope they help. Anyway, 1770 to 1773. During that period, there are new British laws which aggravate tensions with the Americans. There is one incident here in 22. A tax ship or a revenue cutter called the Gaspee washes ashore in Rhode Island late one night. It is looted and burned. But that's probably not so much anti-British spirit as it's just kind of street capitalism. Somebody stranded in the wrong neighborhood kind of thing is all that was. That's probably the case. What is going on between 1770 and 73, however, is an incident in 23 called the Battle of Alamance. In 1771, this battle occurs in western North Carolina. It is an example of a pattern of three different incidences of different time periods. It reflects this setting. In the colonies, when people ask, were there political parties in the colonies prior to independence? There wasn't. First political parties will arise in the 1790s. So while there are no parties running for local office in the colonies, there are factions, and the factions tend to be geographic, east and west. The belief is that those people who lived further east, who had a heritage of relatives before them that owned larger amounts of property, tended to have the greater voice in government. That's very true. If voting is based on property ownership, then they're going to be the ones who got it first and had the most. And you know how it is when it comes to things like gerrymandering. If you have control of a legislature, you redistrict the laws to protect your interests against someone else. So it wasn't unusual in each of the 13 colonies for eastern seaboard wealthy people, be they plantation owners or business shippers or bankers, to control legislatures and pass laws that were beneficial to their interests, and to pass laws that tended to be disadvantageous to the westerners, the frontier people. In fact, the names that go with these people you may see in your textbook are Tidewater Elite, which is your eastern seaboard keeper, or Piedmont Frontiersmen out west. The complaints that Piedmont Frontiersmen consistently uttered was, we are overtaxed, we are underrepresented. When you count up the number of people out west and people out east, there's somehow more representatives than you come from the east. And when the taxes come, they put the heavier taxes on us in proportion to who can afford to pay. And when Indians attack, we're the ones that get attacked, not them, and they should be, paying for militias to protect us. They don't, because they don't get attacked. Might be some comments we're going to hear about the Louisiana situation coming up, and who gets protected, who pays taxes, etc. So that was a consistent complaint up and down the seaboard. In 1771, a group of Western North Carolinians became so disgusted and disenchanted with this setup that they decided, we just aren't even going to pay the taxes, we're not going to even recognize the authority of the North Carolinian government, we will regulate our own affairs, which is where they got the title, the Regulators. And when North Carolina militia were sent to subdue them and suppress them, the Battle of Alamance occurred, which ended up being a victory for the militia, not the Regulators. The Regulators were defeated and forced to recognize the sovereignty of the Eastern government. Two similar incidences had occurred before this. One as early as 1676 in Virginia, called Bacon's Rebellion. And you don't really need to know much about Bacon's Rebellion other than it fits this theme. But it had the same ideas. People living on the West met at House of Burgesses. In this 1676 Virginia story, they marched on the House of Burgesses, took it over in a revolution. Bacon, the leader of the rebellion, caught fever and died, and the rebellion fell apart. So it failed also, but it's built on the same premise. Overtaxed, underrepresented, underdefended. Then in 1763, in the climate of the Pontiac's uprising, is what it was, since Pontiac's strongest attacks came on western Pennsylvania, people in Philadelphia hold on here, I'm not mentally able to talk and do a map at the same time. We're going to take about a 20-second intermission while I figure this out. It is bad, but it's on. All right, okay. All right, now we're back. I know what I'm talking about. Pontiac Uprising, you recall that it occurred out on the western parts of the Appalachians and the borders of New York and Pennsylvania, that the biggest troubles occurred in western Pennsylvania. And so in 1763, a group of Westerners led by fathers and sons Paxton, the Paxton Boys, decided that the people in Philadelphia knew about this uprising and didn't care a lick about Westerners. In fact, kind of wanted to see some of these Westerners killed off. And so they marched on Philadelphia and were going to take over the capital. Hearing of them coming, a citizens committee led by Ben Franklin came out to the city gates and talked them out of it, dissuaded them, promised less, lower taxes and better defense. But all this occurred during the Pontiac Uprising. So it was an unsuccessful uprising too. So in all three cases, the Eastern Seaboard authorities retained control and Westerners were either defeated or quelled. So while this is three different time periods, I jump on the 1771 Alamance Battle as a chance to emphasize each of the three. When we talk about people in the West feeling abused, underrepresented, overtaxed, and underdefended by power in the East, what possible other scenario could we be alluding to? If on the one hand, I'm talking about people living in Eastern Seaboard colonies abusing people in the West, but if you think maybe a bigger theme, what could be the same elements going on there? Somebody back east with all the power and
slaves are in the first.
Well, that fits too. That's very true.
What the British are doing to the colonies?
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of going. The bigger picture. That's how the Americans felt. That the British overtaxed, underrepresented, left them at the mercy of French and Indian attacks. And yes.
Do you think that feeling carried over in this one when we started Congress that you have enough to say everything you said?
Yes, it's stealing the whole punchline. Oh yeah, that's a whole lecture. You just took away the surprise. Exactly. Yeah. And it's more than just the creation of the government. I think that there is a theme and thesis here in American history where people back east were perceived to be, and maybe were, the real power source of money and politics, and successively the West, whether it be the Appalachians or whether it be all the way to the Mississippi or Arizona, California, people in the West always felt like Eastern Seaboard elites or Easterners, uppity Yankee Easterners, control all the money and all the power and we don't get a fair voice and shape. We're looked at as country bumpkins type thing. I think that's probably the great real change on that comes after the 1950s with the invention of air conditioning. And that's the revolution. When you can air condition homes and factories, and people all take off and leave the factories back east and move down south and out west to the Sun Belt, that's when presidents from California like Nixon and Reagan and Texas like Johnson start to make their appearance. Until then, there's little financial or political power west of the Mississippi until after that. So there is a theme to be made. If you were writing, a great book would be The Constant East-West Struggle from the Colonies all the way to now. Even Hillary complained about that, didn't she? That the reason they dissed Bill and me is because we're from Western South, Southern West. They just can't give us respect for Rodney Dangerfield. So yeah, I think that's effective. Now, of course, on the other hand, we have to look at this. One of the reasons this concept is taught in colonial history, the one in item 23, is because leftist historians, like myself, want to try to manipulate the history and claim that there was a class struggle taking place in the colonies, and somehow the wealthy tricked the poor into fighting the British instead of the wealthy. Now that's a fun theory, but there just isn't much proof to it. Especially when in each case, it didn't happen. Yeah, that's it. Now, there will be some more uprisings that reflect this. So you've heard of the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. Again, that's western Pennsylvania upset back east. There's Shays Rebellion in 1787. Again, that's farmers feeling like the bankers are foreclosing on their mortgage. So there are examples, but there's never a united movement. It's just something picked, plucked, and defended. And we can get back to the British abuse anyway here in item 24. as said before, had Parliament refrained from passing any more abusive acts, probably would have been no revolution. But in 1773, a new law called the Tea Act is passed. It's classic mercantilism in this respect. The British East India Tea Company, a favored special monopoly, had been doing almost all of the colonial administration of India, so that England didn't have to. Even though Pitt's reorganized the empire, they're still depending upon one company to run India for them. And according to mercantilism, if you give a preferred status to a monopoly, that allows them to recruit higher profits, which they can funnel back into research and development and always make a better product. The other side of that, of course, is if you have no competition, you get sloppy and flabby, which the British East India Tea Company had done. They had run themselves deeper into debt, and now through their lobby influence in Parliament, they passed another law giving themselves even more monopoly privilege, the Tea Act. What the Tea Act said was this individual company, British East India Tea Company, could sell its tea directly to all markets, ignoring all the other navigation laws except for the Townsend tax on tea. So they don't have to go through English ports and get stamps and pay duties and ship things onto ships that are American or English owned. They can just go directly from market to market and just pay a little bit of the Townsend tax when they get there. Which means for American tea drinkers, they actually could be getting cheaper tea. But for American merchants who have to go through all the products and extra costs, that's an unfair advantage to a competitor. So American merchants are quick to emphasize to American consumers, buy American, don't buy from the British East India Tea Company. That's unpatriotic, that's unloyal. And their appeal works. American tea consumers don't buy the cheaper tea from the British East India Tea Company. Their wares just stack up in backlog in warehouses unsold. And you can also mark something else here in terms of culinary history. It is noted that since people still needed their caffeine, they switched from tea to coffee consumption at this point. Now, there's kind of two reasons. One is the need for the caffeine, but also the drinking of coffee from this point onward showed solidarity and patriotism. So that cup of coffee every day is a sign of patriotism, starting from 1773. We see the appearance in December, in item 26 of 1773, of the Sons of Liberty. They're back fighting for freedom. When they come down to the docks of Boston Harbor, dressed as Native Americans, since the argument was all these soldiers around town are there to protect against Indians, they need to have some Indians. So dressed as Native Americans, they move onto the docks and throw 243 chests of tea into the water off the ships. Act of vandalism. The British parliamentary response to the Tea Party, item 27. Just got a feeling from everybody. Do we have enough for a quiz? Maybe. Let's look and see. Do we have at least 13 facts? I like to have 13 facts here as 3 bonuses. Probably not. Let's wait another month. Anyway, item 27. These laws passed by Parliament in 1774 were collectively known by two names. In Parliament, they were known as the Coercive Acts, but American colonists who rankled over them called them the Intolerable Acts. Let's look at each one and see what it's about. First one is the Boston Port Act, which says that the port of Boston is closed to all shipping, to all business, until somebody pays for the tea. I guess they expected the city itself to pony up the money for it. Second, the Massachusetts Governing Act said that the upper house of the Massachusetts legislature, a two-house legislature, would no longer be elected by citizens. It will be appointed by Parliament. So the two-house legislature, the upper house will no longer be elected by citizens, but appointed by parliament, which of course means going to be appointed by special plans that are favorable to British interests. So this would mean that any laws being, and the way the legislatures work, unlike our current national or even state legislatures, was that there were upper and lower houses in most of these legislatures. A bill would start in the lower house, work its way from there to the upper house, which means they don't start either house but the other. They always end up in the upper house. So if the upper house is appointed, every single bill can be killed by the passage of the monarch, or not the monarch, but of the parliament. So now the New York legislature has been closed down because it won't appropriate money for billeting. The Massachusetts upper house is in the hands of parliamentary stooges, so to speak. The Administration of Justice Act has passed. This is a law that said if British officials are brought to court on malfeasant activities, if like say a tax collector or a policeman or a constable or governor's aide is stealing from parking meters or sleeping with Monica or whatever might be the crime, you know, and lying about it, that's the crime, lying about it, that they will not be tried in colonial court, but they'll either be sent to a Canadian court, back to England, or a naval court. Now, if they're not tried in the venue where the crime or the supposed crime took place, what's going to be the complaints on the part of the colonists? Yeah, they're not going to even get convicted. These people can abuse colonists, violate the law, be tyrants, and there's no check and balance over them in a local court. Is there any argument on the other side for these people? That's just true? That they're just going to get away with abuse? Could the British make any sound, reasonable argument for shifting these venues out of colonial courts?
They wouldn't get a fair trial.
They wouldn't get a fair trial either. That's how bad public opinion was, that you could not get a fair jury anymore out of colonial courts because public opinion was so anti-British that regardless of the facts, they're going to get convicted. So this tells us something about how bad public spirit has been soured by Massacre, the Tea Party, and now the Intolerable Acts. And then the final one, the Quartering Act, which we already alluded to, the 1774 Quartering Act, said that since colonists have not appropriated money to build the barracks, they'll now be placed in people's private homes. So all these laws, Boston Port Act, Massachusetts Governing Act, Administration of Justice Act and Quartering Act, what was the great terrible crime that brought about such punishment? Vandalism. Vandalism, but it's more than that, obviously. It is an effort by Parliament to crack down and try to intimidate colonists to toe the line. They add one more law. It's not considered an intolerable act. It's not passed at the same time, but bureaucratic blockheadedness causes it to come at a worse time. It's called the Quebec Act, 1774. It will add to colonial resentment. Oh, it feels like a good quiz. No quiz. The Quebec Act said the southern boundary of Quebec would extend as far south as the Ohio River. It means that all of the present-day Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin would be part of Canada. The southern boundary of Quebec would go from the Great Lakes all the way down to the Ohio River. So land that was supposed to originally, back in 1748, supposed to be the Ohio colony, is first retained in the hands of Native Americans and now is considered part of Canada. It's not going to be seemingly open up to settlement. Also, the Quebec Act said that, well, how can I put this? Canadians had not had legislatures. They had worked on the basis of a governor issues an order from the monarch. England tried after 1763 as a way to pacify conquered French Canadians to let them elect their own legislature to make local law. They said, look at the American colonists, do what they're doing, then you won't feel so occupied. And the French just didn't have a history of doing that, and didn't do it very well, and didn't tax themselves like they should have, and all this kind of thing. So the British just disbanded the legislature and said, we'll just make law from Parliament. Which did not cause a great upsurge of anger in the Canadians, because they were lackluster about to start with. But in the minds of the Americans, what's it perceived as? The crushing of liberty. They closed down the New York legislature. They closed down the Massachusetts upper house. Now they closed down the Canadian legislature. This is step by step. The closing down of legislatures is tyranny, how they see this. Then they also give the Canadians a privilege which the Americans don't like, and that is Canadians were French Catholics. But they had been pressured since the time of the French and Indian War to pay taxes to support the Anglican Church, which they didn't like. So in an effort to try to make it easier to focus on making the Americans behave, they said, you don't have to pay any more money for the Anglican Church. So the Quebec Act seems to give the boundaries to the enemy French Canadians, takes away their legislature, and gives them the privilege of not having to pay taxes to the Anglican Church, while at the same time Americans are getting hit with taxes they don't want. So you add the Quebec Act to the four Intolerable Acts, and all five of those, with Samuel Adams' committees of correspondence and his circular letters, this is a ripe time for real bad unrest, leading to item 29. The First Continental Congress gathered. Here they are doing exactly what the British figured they would not do. Unite. Or at least getting together to talk about uniting. About having common cause against the British. At this gathering, the great majority of public opinion was, what can we do to get the British to leave us alone? Send some of these unfair taxes, let us manage our own affairs. There was next to no support for an independence movement. Samuel Adams was there. Samuel Adams did speak up. Patrick Henry from Virginia also was outspoken about independence. They were looked at as radical extremists, like abortion clinic bombers at that time. They really were. They were looked at as, these people are going to get us into a war that we can't win. Don't listen to them. Of course, they later do get us into the war that we do win. So what instead is decided at the First Continental Congress is an agreement is signed that all the delegates there, representing 12 states, I believe Georgia was not at this gathering. The Suffolk Resolve shows each of the colonies declaring they will support Massachusetts and Boston's refusal to pay for the tea, even if it means they suffer retribution by Parliament. They stand by the refusal to pay for the tea. It's an act of solidarity. Bostonian Joseph Galloway suggests the same thing that Ben Franklin suggested back at the Albany Plan. Some kind of a union, some kind of a home rule arrangement. Why don't we make an offer to Britain to set up a system where there is control over the colonies locally, it reports to Parliament, and colonists report to it, and we'll be it. We'll have a voice over our own affairs in a united fashion. Voted on, rejected by one vote. Galloway would later remain a loyalist throughout the Revolutionary War. They draw up a list of what's called a Declaration of Rights and Grievances in item 30. Which is just a laundry list of all the complaints, where these laws have been unfair. They went back to the Stamp Act, went back to the Currency and Sugar Act, mentioned where Parliament overstepped its bounds, internal external taxes, direct representation arguments. All of these constitutional arguments are made, suggesting that we want you to take seriously our complaints or else, have an or else hanging after it. It's ignored by Parliament. So this is what's happening at the end of 1774, as fall turns to winter. Getting any kind of positive response from Parliament, there begins the greater formation of militias. And these militias drill and practice regularly with weapons. Recognizing this, the governor of Massachusetts, who you do not have to remember his name, Hutchinson's his name, later to replace by Gage, begins to issue orders that weapons being used for militia training are to be confiscated. And there are dates given as to at what point these are to be turned over, which they're not going to be, obviously. And this is where our Second Amendment comes from. Finally, in April of 1775, it's decided that these weapons have to be taken, and they're going to be taken in one day. On April 19, 1775, it's decided that British troops will be sent to where these arms are stored. The spy networks have identified them as Lexington and Concord. But the night before, on April 18, 1775, what occurs instead? In the Longfellow poem, it's the Midnight Parade of Paul Revere. Three people actually are involved in this. It's not just Paul Revere, there's Billy Dawes and Samuel Prescott are involved in writing also. Both Prescott and Revere never made it. They were captured. But it's Billy Dawes that finally gets the information through about the British marching the next day, and that's why the arms are restored and hidden away somewhere else, and so are two people that were to be arrested. John Hancock and Samuel Adams were targeted to be arrested that day, and they were hidden away. Revere gets the credit because Longfellow wrote the poem, but all three were involved. So on the next day, on April 19, 1775, when the British regulars do attack Lexington and Concord, that is the official start, I guess you could say, the first bloodshed, continuous Revolutionary War action. Another poem commemorates this. It's written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. You don't have to write down. It's just I listen and get excited about that. Called the Concord Hymn. It has this line in it that you heard. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. And here once the embattled farmer stood and did what? That's the last line. You heard this. And fired the shot heard round the world. You heard that line. That's where it comes from. This 1830 poem by Emerson. When you consider 1830, what might have Emerson been trying to put into this poem? Very much so. Romanticizing the American Revolution. Let's look at the history. What's by 1830, what's happened worldwide? Europe-wise. Well, there's been a French Revolution. Britain's definitely not the superpower. Britain itself has undergone constitutional changes. It's far more democratic as a result of the loss of American colonies. In Latin America, almost all of Spain's colonies have declared their independence, many of them launching revolutions based on the American model with bills of rights and constitutions and celebrating people who are like the Washington and Jefferson and Adams people. So by 1830, the world is definitely, the Western Europe part of the world, is definitely in the throes of democratic revolution. Eastern Europe is not changed yet, but it's feeling threatened. For Eastern European rulers and monarchs, there's a series of revolts in 1830 that are repeated later in 1848. They definitely feel, in fact, you could say this, by 1830, the mood of many monarchs in Europe was probably the same mood that America had in the 1940s and 50s. There's a worldwide communist revolution spreading. We've got to be on guard, except in this case, it was a worldwide democratic revolution spreading. And who were the pesky troublemakers that started this whole mess? The Americans. And that's exactly what Emerson is proud of. So fire the shot heard around the world really implies kicked off the worldwide democratic revolution. And it did happen. The French don't like to admit to that. The French argue that ours is a conservative revolution to maintain things. Theirs is a true radical revolution. But they're wrong. According to me. Sorry for that. Well, that leads to a second gathering, a second Continental Congress in item 32. One that will continue to meet until the end of the war. In fact, will continue to meet until the Constitution in 1789. This is the representative body that led the American colonies through the Revolutionary War. They now recognize that military conflict has started and will continue. And if they expect this to be a success, they've got to have somebody who's capable, and they didn't have many people with military experience, so they turned to Washington. And he's the obvious choice to be commander of a united Continental Army. Their purpose for fighting is not independence. Even though people like Hancock and Adams and Henry are all saying it's obvious, you must go for immediate independence, that wasn't conceived as doable, winnable. So its thinking is there's going to be an insurgency resistance movement that just gnaws away at Britain until they walk off. That's the purpose of the Second Continental Congress, is creation of a Continental Army. They put together something very similar to the rights and grievances, the Olive Branch Petition. The Olive Branch Petition is a document that again lists the complaints and problems, but says to the king, we don't think you're at fault. We think only Parliament's at fault. We're your loyal subjects. We're willing to stay your loyal subjects if you'll get this phony, illegal institution to quit passing these phony, illegal laws. Just recognize that we make our own local laws. We'll still pay taxes that are navigation laws. We never had a complaint about that. If you want to have external laws that apply to everybody, we'll pay them. But you start passing laws that apply only to us, that should be our local legislatures. When we get that constitutional argument straight, that's the end of the revolution. Now, they really didn't expect the king to cave in on this, because it was well known that the king was sympathetic to Parliament's actions, looked down upon the Americans. In fact, most leaders of Parliament and the monarch looked at the Americans as country bumpkins beneath the elite, who don't, even if they have a constitutional argument, they're not going to cave into it. So they didn't really expect any kind of satisfaction out of the king. There is another purpose behind this Olive Branch Petition. It's a paper trail. Leaders of the Second Continental Congress, they're thinking down the road that if it turns that the resistance isn't enough, and it's going to have to be a full-scale independence war, one of the hardest things you're going to have to deal with is how to get people to break their feeling from the king. It's one thing to be mad at Parliament, but there's a certain emotional attachment that people feel towards a monarch. And the only way you're going to cut that attachment is to have a paper trail where this guy was a scoundrel, where you tried to reason with him and he just wouldn't reason. If you're going to cut attachment to the monarch, you've got to have something along the way to show we tried to reason with this guy. And that is used later in the Declaration. So that brings us up to 32, and getting that look and feel again like you've had enough. So no quiz next time, just more exciting notes next time. Picking up with item 33.